In this episode of Startups the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be giving updates on Bluetick and Drip. This is Startups the Rest of Us, episode 309. Welcome to Startups the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's more this week, Rob?
Well, yeah, more than this week. I think we're talking about stuff that's been going on for the past few months, right? Because we haven't done an updates episode in a long time. We used to try to do these once a month or so, and then there were certain extents of time where so much was going on that I couldn't talk about. I think stuff slowed down for you for a while, and I think it's really time to get back here and get back at it and give folks an update. And it would be nice to do these a little more often. I don't know if we'll do them monthly, but I always find it fun and interesting to talk about what we're doing. And the feedback that I've heard in general is that folks really like to hear more about what we're up to.
Cool. So let's dive right in.
Yeah. So for me, you know, I look back, it's been just over 3 months since Drip was acquired. For those who haven't been listening, I had a startup called Drip. I co-founded it as email marketing software, and it was acquired by LeadPages back in July. And so now I work for LeadPages. I moved with my family to Minneapolis, and it has been quite an adventure. I think the hardest part of the transition was definitely, well, aside from the acquisition itself, that was very stressful. Once that was done, the hardest part has been the move and the impact it's had on the family. Moves are always stressful, and I think that it's a bummer when you move and your kids are all disjointed and don't know what to do, and they're homesick, and then they go to school and they don't have any friends, and then it's a transition to a new place. We've tried to fill it with like adventure and making it exciting. And now that we have been in Minneapolis just over 2 months and everybody's over it, and now it feels like home, and nobody talks about, you know, how they liked the Fresno house more or about how rough school is because they're having fun. So that was a big transition, and I feel like we're past it, and it feels really good to be past it. And I don't think I want to move anytime soon again. It's you've done some moves in your time, huh?
I haven't moved for at least 10 years, and there are good reasons why.
Yeah, because you remember how hard it was. Even, I mean, we, you know, we hired movers, like everything was paid for. And so we hired people to pack and move us and unload us. I mean, we didn't do any of the hard work. The unpacking sucks, of course. But even then, it was so much time to do all the logistics, and then your stuff gets here, and then the unpacking is just days and days of chaos. And yeah, it's stressful. It reminded me how stressful this actually is, but it's good to be past it. And on the flip side, like the transition, the work transition to LeadPages has been like way, way easier. I don't want to say it's been a breeze, because that would probably be glossing over some things, but in general, it's been a very good transition for me. And I think for the team, I talk to everybody, I try to keep tabs on even our remote folks, and it's kind of business as usual, but we have a lot more money to do things. We just have more resources. So it's like business as usual, but better, I think is kind of how I've been talking about it. There are obviously things I had to give up that weren't, you know, it wasn't the easiest to give up all of the marketing essentially. And I could be as involved as I want, but frankly, I don't have time given the focus on the product and the hiring of engineers and stuff that I'm doing now. But that was a tough choice, because I've always marketed my own products, and LeadPages is so, they're just so good at it. You know, I mean, they're, in my opinion, and from the outside and now that I'm inside, like they're one of the best SaaS top of the funnel marketers in the world. It's just an amazing machine that they've built. So it makes total sense that they would do this, right? When they have a team of 20 or 30 people, why would I want to, you know, slow them down and be a bottleneck essentially? So, but giving up the marketing website was a tough choice. Giving up some of the, and not even a choice. It was, I knew it had to happen. It was inevitability. It was just when it was going to happen. And of course they cranked on it and rolled out a nice new, gorgeous marketing site. It's at drip.co. If you go there, you'll see it. And they have videos and they have all types of cool stuff that just would have taken me months and or years and a bunch of contractors and way more money than I had to produce. And then they, you know, they spit it out after it was 3 or 4 weeks. It was, this whole website was up. So it's pretty cool.
What was the reasoning behind the domain name transition? It used to be getdrip.com and now it's drip.co.
Yeah, it was to get away from people calling the app GetDrip. People on podcasts and all the time, hey, how's your app GetDrip doing? And it's like, well, that's not what it's, it's not called Get Drip, it's called Drip. And so we, you know, for a long time I had wanted obviously drip.com, which I think there was a squatter on it and he wanted six figures. That wasn't going to happen. But yeah, you know, LeadPages was able to get drip.co on the secondary market, and it probably at the price, I don't know if I would have put the money towards it bootstrapped, but it made total sense to do it given the resources they have. So that was the idea. And it's, I mean, it's a 4-letter domain, 6 letters including the extension, so it's nice and short, memorable, and just nice to not be called GetDrip anymore.
Back when you could actually get 4-letter domains.
Yeah, I know.
It's a thing of the past.
I know. Well, Clay sought it out and bought it on the secondary market.
Very cool. Couple of quick personal updates. My brother's getting married this weekend, so we're whole family's leaving tomorrow morning.
Wait,
so we're recording
you
on
have
a Thursday.
A brother?
Yeah.
How long have you and I known each other?
I don't know. Like 10 years.
10 or 11 years? You have a brother? Do you have any? How many brothers do you have?
He's technically a half brother. He's 16 years younger than me.
Got it.
So,
okay. You just don't ever talk about him.
I almost never see him, you know? So.
Do you have a sister too?
I do.
You're kidding me. What? No, you did. It's like, I just figured you were an only child. You never talk about your siblings. Do you know I have siblings? I talk about them, right? Every now and again?
I do know that you have them. I don't know how many. I think you have a brother, but I don't think you have a sister.
Yeah, I do. I'm the youngest of four kids. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
With a sister and two brothers. Dude, how many siblings do you have?
Well, it's complicated.
Oh my God. So two of mine are half as well, to be honest. I have two half siblings and then one full.
Yeah, my status, let's see, my parents, they got divorced when I was much younger. So, and then they both remarried. And on one side, I've got a stepsister and three stepbrothers. And then there's also a half brother there. And then on the other side, I've got, five step siblings in some way, shape, or form. I think that there's two boys and three girls. I don't ever talk to them because I'm just never around. But yeah, it's kind of crazy. So there's like 10.
Got it. All right. So you're going to a wedding.
Yep. So going to a wedding this weekend. We're leaving tomorrow morning. It'll be Friday morning. You know, wedding's on Saturday. We come back on Sunday. And then next week's Columbus Day. And then the other thing is I have to go off on a little bit of a rant here. It's about Amazon and big data. And I went on Amazon and I'm very particular when it comes to notebooks. And I'm sure people have their quirks about that sort of thing. But I like this. There's this very specific type of engineering paper that I like for my notepads. So I went on Amazon and I bought one. And next thing I know, they're trying to cram like calculus and physics books down my throat. I'm like, dear God, please make it stop.
Yeah, that's brutal.
So it was just like the entire line of recommendations from Amazon was nothing but like college textbooks. And I'm just like, no, I don't want a $300 calculus book.
It's such a bummer. Yeah. I wish there was a button you could click to be like, dismiss these. Because that happens to me. My kids get on and shop, or Sherry will get on and buy psychology books. And it's like, oh, stop recommending that stuff to me.
Yeah. And it even happens if you like borrow stuff from Amazon's library. They'll say, oh, well, you downloaded this thing about Barney the dinosaur. You might be interested in this too. I'm like, please stop.
No doubt.
But aside from that, I've been talking about this for a while, but I finally finished migrating all the back-end mailbox data inside of Bluetick. So everything's over on like a completely new storage mechanism. It's not even a different storage system. It's just everything is all indexed now and stored in a different way than it was before, which makes it easier to get at the data and then make sure that everything's synchronized. And I've got manual indices that are built around a bunch of stuff so that I can, given any email address, for example, I can very quickly show you exactly who has emailed you from that email address or all the emails that you've sent to that email address, which you can do inside of Gmail or most email clients, but it's a lot more difficult when you're trying to synchronize those things yourself. And the other thing that I'm able to do is I'm actually able to tie multiple email addresses to a single person. So that's a kind of an interesting side effect of doing all this myself, is that I can create those additional tie-ins that would probably be very difficult to do outside of something like Gmail or Outlook. So then I can show you like all the different communications that you've had with somebody. And the idea down the road is to be able to take that stuff and present it inside of the application so that you can see all of the activity related to somebody, regardless of what email address was used to send to them or received from them. So if you have a team, you'll be able to see all the emails that have been received by your team from that person. And then you'll be able to mark things as, you know, like, hey, this particular email was a private one. I don't want that shared with the whole team. And you can set preferences around that stuff. But the other thing it allows us to do is download the contents of those messages and display those as well. So it's kind of a first step down that path. It's all looking good. I mean, it was several million emails later and a huge WTF moment in the middle where I found that somebody had an email that was 65,000 characters long in the subject line.
Ooh. Wow. Okay. So you truncating, right? You're going to truncate it 256?
Oh, yeah. I totally truncated that.
Okay.
But I was not expecting it to go above, you know, like, I was like, okay, well, maybe I could see somebody putting like a few hundred characters in there. But the application just choked on it. And it took me the longest time to figure it out. And it's just like, oh, whoops. Yeah. That's that's a no-brainer decision to truncate that, but it's just, that's what the spec says. I mean, apparently there's no rules against it.
It broke something, yeah. So are you, you know, I was actually talking with a group of people a couple weeks ago, and they started asking me about Bluetick and about the progress you're making and about the technical issues that you've been mired in for the past, 30 days, 60 days? And they were kind of asking, like, what's going on with Bluetick? Like, is Mike going to launch? Is this another Autotrark? I mean, they started peppering me with questions, and I was like, I don't know. Like, people not realize you and I don't talk off. I mean, this is our conversation every week, right? We have maybe a talk about MicroConf, but we don't dig into each other's apps and progress and that kind of stuff. And so I think this is an interesting thing to dig into here, because if I were to recount what I've seen over the past, which is October. So if I thought back about the last 6 months since MicroConf, I feel like you've been working on a bunch of technical stuff, mired in technical detail. And I know you've worked with some early access folks, and most of them came through as far as I know, and they're using the app, but it does feel like it's been really slow going.
Yeah, it has. And I don't discount those thoughts. I mean, I've had kind of the same thoughts and reservations myself about, like, the fact that certain things are just taking an extraordinary amount of time. And part of it's just because of some of it's the volume of data that I run into. So you do a migration and you're targeting 2 million email messages. And then it was like 1.5 million through it where something went wrong. And I'm like, okay, now I have to figure out not only where exactly did this happen, because it's not always easy to pinpoint that stuff either. And doing a partial migration is a little bit challenging. So the volume of some of those things is just in terms of, like, the prototyping, because I've had to go through a lot of issues with trying to figure out, like, okay, how long is it going to take to query this particular thing? And you don't think about those things when there's only 100 or 1,000 items, but when you've got 150, 250,000 of them, it makes a big difference about whether it takes a half second to query it or 3 minutes. And sometimes it does take a long time. And one of the things I found out is, like, mail servers will time out on you if you don't issue a command within, like, a second, for example. And it's just like, well, that's not really going to work if all this stuff on the back end doesn't respond a lot faster. And it sucks to be mired in those technical details, but at the same time, I feel like a lot of them are kind of past me at this point. So I'm really starting to kind of shift my focus from the engineering side of things into marketing, which I'm kind of thankful for, because it means that I don't have to deal with a lot of those edge cases. I mean, I think they'll still come up, but I don't feel like the rest of the stuff that's going on or that needs to be done is so critical that I have to not move forward with the app and I have to pay attention to it. I think that they're little things. They're little tweaks and little changes here and there, as opposed to, like, okay, this needs to be fundamentally, like, redesigned in order to make this work. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I mean, you know, given the conversations we've had over the past 5 years on this podcast, you know, about you building AutoShark and then now, you know, now about Bluetick, you do have a tendency to get kind of stuck in technical stuff and to spend more time than probably is good for you before you get more people using it. And I'm wondering, like, how can it be different this time?
I think part of it's just making sure that people are using the app. And I think early on, I made the mistake of trying to go in the opposite direction, where I hired several developers to come on and help build the app. And while they were building the app, I basically was very hands-off. And I haven't really talked about this before, but I hired 3 developers back in January. They built the app, got it to launch, or at least got it to the point where it was minimally usable, and then, you know, ran into various UX and UX issues with the front end of the app. And then there's a bunch of stuff that needed to be redesigned on the back end. Like, as I started digging into it, as I said, I tried to kind of do the opposite of what I did with AutoShark. I'm like, okay, I won't touch any of the technical stuff. But then once we got to the point where I started putting it in front of people, we were like, okay, this needs to be changed, mainly because it just doesn't do what the customer needed it to do. And we went in to make some of those changes, and the structure of many of the things was just fundamentally flawed. So, for example, permissions were all screwed up. The API was a total mess. And, like, a lot of the stuff that connected the back end to the front end, it was just the interfacing was terrible. It made it very difficult to make changes. And there was a lot of heavy dependencies between those things. So if you changed one thing, it was very easy to break a bunch of other things. And because we tried to move quickly, we didn't write very many unit tests. And we still don't have nearly as many tests as I would like, which makes it painful. And it makes me very hesitant to push that deploy button, because I know that I don't exactly have a great strategy for, like, rolling things back if something goes wrong. I'm working with a lot of production data, and if something goes wrong, I need to be able to have time to fix it and be reasonably confident that I'm not going to just destroy a whole bunch of data that I'm going to have to go back and somehow try to rebuild.
The lack of unit tests, that's brutal. I mean, that is a big, that's like a classic mistake, and it, you know, that people still continue to make, but now you're like kind of hamstrung by it, right? Because you, it's just not good. We see this happen with certain software companies that aren't built by software developers. They like are heavy marketers, and they kind of, you know, outsource the development, and then they find out 6 to 12 months in, they're like, oh, we have no unit tests, and you know, our code base is terrible, and although we have customers, we can't build new features. Your velocity just completely comes to a halt. And it sounds like you hit that already.
I did. Yeah. And like I said, part of it was because the app was not designed with the levels of scale that need to be taken into account when you're dealing with mailboxes. Like I said, it's a fundamentally different story when you're dealing with like the expectation, oh, there's going to be 100 items in here. So let me give you a very specific example. When you first connect your mailbox to the application, there's a backend process that goes in and it looks at your emails and says, okay, let me find people that you may have emailed within the last X time period. And I'm going to show you when the first contact that you ever made with them was, when the last contact was, who made it in each direction. And that way you can very quickly and easily go in there. And once you've hooked up your mailbox, it will show you a list and you can just sort it and say, okay, who have I sent an email to in the last, let's say, 3 months that never replied to me or only replied once or twice, or I'm still waiting for a reply. Those are things that you can query in there, but at very low volumes, that works fine. But when you scale it up and like there's people who have thousands and thousands of contacts, people that they've either sent emails to or received emails from, and you go from 100 to 10,000, and suddenly lots of things break. And it's not like it's an isolated incident either. It's like several people had this problem. So going back and trying to re-engineer those things so that they actually work has been just like very, very difficult. And like you're right, I ran into these things much earlier than I kind of anticipated. And the kind of point I was kind of getting at before, which as I said, I haven't really talked about this. I hired the 3 developers. I would say shortly after I got it to the point where it was minimally usable, I ended up letting one of them go because I looked at the stuff he was doing. And as I said, I tried to stay hands off. I tried to stay out of it. And then I go back and look at it and I left him in charge. And I said, you're responsible for this. And then I go back and look at it and it's just way off base. It was very clear in retrospect, like, okay, this guy probably didn't know really what he was doing. And I left him in charge of like huge pieces of the infrastructure. And then over the next couple of months, like one of my other developers, he was very, very good at a lot of the front end stuff, but he ended up getting married and moving out of the country and basically wasn't able to do any more work for me. And then the third one, there was a lot of micromanagement that was involved. So I went from 3 developers to 0. And now I'm back up to 1 and it's more of a senior developer and he's very good. I'm very pleased with the work so far. He's been able to get in there and be productive, but that's only happened within the last month or so. And his time at the moment is very limited. So I'm trying to transition things over, but it's been a long, hard road for the past like 3 or 4 months.
So you had 3 hiring mistakes then?
One of them was definitely not a mistake. The other one, she probably would have worked out had I been able to spend more time, but I didn't have the time to sit there and give direction. So like basically I had to be very specific about everything, almost to the point of micromanaging, and it wasn't a good fit ultimately. So 2 out of 3, I would say. The third one, like I said, his life circumstances changed. So there's really not much you can foresee about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of setbacks though. I mean, that's a lot of things to kind of happen in a short period of time.
Yeah. But I mean, I am very conscious of the fact that like, I don't want this to turn into another audit shark story, because that's certainly not the direction I want to go. So at the moment, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to transition myself out of doing more of the coding work and more over into the marketing side of things. So next up for me is to essentially start looking at getting the sign up page in place and carving out some more of the onboarding emails, potentially looking at like an onboarding wizard, because I think that there's got to be something there to help onboard people into the app. But whether that's a combination of videos or tutorials or individually onboarding people with onboarding sessions, I'm okay with that too. But it's a matter of getting people to the point that they're able to be productive with the app as soon as possible.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. I mean, I think you need to, you know, start building some momentum here, because it feels like you've been stalled for a while. And just looking at that that shortest line between you and getting more customers using it, that's what I'd be looking to do right now. And I don't have necessarily advice just because I don't know all what needs to be done, what has been done, what your path is. But I think if there's, you know, if there's one piece of advice I could offer, it's like figure out how to get more people using and paying you for it as quickly as possible and then do that. And that may be building a website and that may not be. Maybe just continuing to manually onboard people for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment, I think, to consider, like, do I even need to rebuild the website? I mean, because it's right now it's just like a one page site. It really does not do anything. There's nothing that you can do aside from sign up for the email list. And then from there, I have a email course that I send people. It's about 5,000 words or so over the course of 5 emails. And that does pretty well at getting people to kind of take that next step. But it's also heavily slanted more towards like, hey, this is a beta. Contact us if you're interested. It's not so much a push the product and let people know what it can do for them. It's more of a showing them how to do things as opposed to, hey, here's how this product can really help make things better for you. And part of that's just a result of the fact that when it was written before the product was launched or even available. So I've got to go back and rework a lot of that, not a lot of the copy, but at least some of the calls to action in the emails.
One thing you could think about, and again, I don't know your roadmap, your plan or anything, but just hearing where you're at and what you're doing, one thing you could consider is either during that email course or instead of the email course, actually on the one page, just swap that out with a request a demo button. And the request a demo could lead to directly to your Calendly page where people can just book themselves with a demo. It could lead to like a Google form that asks for more information first, and then you get back in touch. And the Google form might, or a type form or whatever, might be better because then you can get an idea of, you get more info from them, right? And you can tell how much they might be paying you because, you know, I'm assuming you're pricing tiers up based on seats or something like that. So you could ask mm-hmm. them how many seats they expect, what they expect the product to do. Like that could be really interesting and it would be super fast, right? And then if you just improved that single page marketing site and didn't really build everything out, that could save you some time and get you to the point where you're just driving people. Because I still think at this point, like having like automatic sign up, no touch sign up, I don't know that you're there yet. I don't know quite where the product is, but my guess is you still have more to build and you still need to figure out exactly what to build next in order to get it to the point where you could just send hundreds of, you know, new trials, so to speak, through the funnel and actually have them stick. And so I feel like doing demos and having more, driving more in-person conversations, that's probably where what I would lean towards at this point.
That's probably true. I kind of put it in my head like, hey, these are the things that are on the list of things to do. And I kind of naturally surfaced like, oh, the website really needs some love and care. So I kind of naturally surfaced that to the front of my brain. But I think you're right. It's probably not necessarily the best place to be spending my time right now.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly, you take your one page landing page. It's at bluetick.io, by the way, for the listeners out there, and maybe improve the copy a bit or just rewrite it based on what you know now. And not even rewrite the whole thing. Just add some bits here and there and then have a big quest to demo button. And just gate it for now. And people who are interested in a demo, then at least you can have a conversation with them. You can see what kind of volume you're getting. And you can have conversations with them both because it's easier to sell things that way. And you'll be able to figure out how best to explain it. You can kind of split test your message really quick. And then you can start taking notes on what your message is and then use that for the, you know, when you revamp the page. And then it'll also just give you a ton of feedback about someone who comes in and is like, oh, there's another tool I use and it does exactly this. Or if you added this one feature, I would use it. You know, those conversations are just so valuable in this early stage.
Yeah, I agree. I had a demo that I did last Friday, I think. And I took notes before the demo, and then I made it a point to take notes right afterwards about specifically what the objections that they had were, and then wrote those down so that I could come up with answers that were significantly better than what I had, so that I had something that was already written, already concrete, as opposed to trying to think something up off the top of my head. And I've done that before, and it works really well when you consciously do it, but it's very easy to just kind of overlook that. The other thing I did was I had a VA go out and capture all of the marketing messages from, I think it was a list of about 30 different competitors that I put together. So I've got all their primary calls to action and primary marketing headlines that they're using, and then all the secondary headlines. And then if they had any sort of bulleted lists about topics or pieces of information that they were trying to convey on some of the different pages, I had her capture those as well. And then I also had her build like a feature comparison breakdown, which is more for me than kind of for a general consumption, but it will help give me an idea of when I get the question about, oh, well, I see competitor XYZ does this. How does Bluetick do that? Or how does Bluetick relate to competitor XYZ? What do you do better and what do you do worse? And I've been asked that question before and I haven't been able to answer it for specific competitors. So I got that information so that I could help answer those questions better.
Whenever anyone says, can you compare Drip to XYZ competitor? I always say, yeah, we're better. People don't find it very funny. I actually, for some reason, those questions, they kind of infuriate me because it's like, A, we in particular have, I think there's like 400 or more email marketing apps. So people just name some app off the top of their head that no one's ever heard of except for this person. There's like 10 users and it's like, I don't know how we're different. I mean, major competitors, we can say we're easier to use, we're easier to get onboarded, we're less expensive, we're more powerful than most of our competitors. But to actually do a feature by feature comparison is really kind of a bit of work there.
It wasn't so much that I wanted to be able to provide a matrix to somebody, but I really wanted to kind of know what specific areas of the space that they operated in. So like, are they more geared towards cold outbound emails, or are they more about sales funnel flow, or are they more about a CRM package? I mean, there's very different ways to look at the sales process and different pieces of it that different competitors do better or worse. Because for example, somebody asked, well, what's the difference between this and HiRISE? I'm like, well, HiRISE is a CRM. It's not a mechanism for actually doing anything. I hate to kind of gloss over some of the difficulties or all the engineering behind something like HiRISE. But at the end of the day, a CRM is basically a database. It's a database of contacts and it doesn't usually do anything for you. Whereas with Bluetick, it's more about automating the process of moving somebody from one step of your sales funnel to the next and making that visible to everybody. Now, you can argue that, okay, well, that's a CRM. That's exactly what that does. But most CRMs don't necessarily have built-in functionality that does a lot more than that. They don't do a lot of that automation right inside the app. They rely on a lot of external processes, external APIs, webhooks, that kind of stuff. And Bluetick has some of that stuff built right into it.
I think this still points to you probably needing to find out exactly how to describe Bluetick. And, you know, before you were saying it was sales automation software, and I actually like that, but now I'm realizing it may need to even be more specific. And it's like sales email automation software or email-based sales automation software or something like that, because that's really what it does, right? You could say it's sales automation and someone might think, oh, is it going to do cold calls for me? Is it going to, you know, that could mean a lot of things, but like you're really specifically focusing on using email to move people through a funnel. And so I think still seeking that description is something, you know, that you should probably be doing over the next few weeks and months.
Yes and no. The email piece of it is like the V1. It's just like the version one piece of it. So like I've had conversations with people about like automating text messages, for example. So like they get a list of customers they've done business with and they have high volume and they want to be able to turn around and send text messages to their customers and hook it up through Twilio, for example, so that they can have those replies go directly into Bluetick. Well, that's kind of like a secondary, I don't want to say secondary action, but it's an additional mechanism for interacting with the customer. So you could have email, you could have phone call in theory, like that could initially just be like you plug something in and write down what you talked about. But I think that close.io actually goes an extra step beyond that and even records the calls and allows you to make calls through close.io.
Right.
I'm not saying I want to do that, but.
Yeah, but I think you're getting ahead of yourself. I think if you called yourself email sales automation at this point and then later on you drop it, like we, you know, you think about Drip and it was like we were like epic autoresponders early on, right? And it was all about the promise of raising conversion rates with the email capture widget. And then it was like, oh, now we're automation software, email automation. And then it's like, well, now we're marketing automation. You know, I mean, we evolved over time. So don't feel like because you call it email sales automation, and I'm not saying that's the term to use, but if you picked one that had the word email in it, you can change that later, right? When you add SMS.
Yeah.
And you adding SMS, I'm guessing is 6 months out. So it gives you plenty of time and maybe more, maybe 6 to 12 months. I mean, I think there's still a lot of progress to be made with just the email front.
Yeah. I mean, there's a boatload of stuff that could be done. It's more a matter of prioritizing it. And I had a brief discussion with my developer this morning. We were talking about even just like a data import. And we kind of scaled it really, really far back in terms of what the initial plans were, because it was just like, okay, well, we could do everything that we want to do, but it's probably going to take at least a month. And it's really just not worth the time investment at this point. So we scaled it back. It'll probably take a couple of days to do it instead of a month, which obviously frees up time to do a lot of other things. But now that I'll say that the bulk of the cleanup work is done, and I really do feel that way. Like a lot of the technical debt that we assumed early on to get something out the door as quick as possible, a lot of that stuff has kind of gone away at this point, and it's a lot easier to make changes now, and there's more documentation, everything's more standardized, the code itself has not got three different standards that, you know, the code is adhering to, and it's just a lot more manageable. So hopefully at this point we can move considerably faster than we were before.
Some other things from my side, as I was reflecting on the past kind of 3 months of after the acquisition, I talked about a few of these things, but there's a lot has gone on, you know, with in terms of drip. Like, we launched a $1 plan, we doubled our affiliate commissions, which was nice to do, up to 30% recurring. We've hired 3 engineers, which has been extremely time consuming. I forget how much time it is to start from nothing and to write a job description and to post it, take the incoming clients. The nice part is LeadPages has a recruiter, and so she actually goes out and emails people and prospects, essentially, and which I was doing in the old days, and it's just so much stuff that I used to do that I'm able to hand off to other people. So, but even then, all the interviews, and yet the phone interviews and the in-person interviews and then decision and then the salary negotiation, just all that stuff, even though I'm not handling all of it, it still does require a lot of time and energy. So hired 3 engineers, which has been mostly, that's been like the bulk of my job, bulk of my time in a week doing that. And then I'm hiring 1 more new employee here in the next couple weeks, interviewing people right now. And then I hope to slow down hiring. I don't really expect to keep growing at this pace. It's actually, I think I'm a big believer in small teams and being super efficient, scrappy, and agile. And I think that growing the team too large too quickly is really a mistake that some startups make. And then you see them slow down, and because if it gets bigger, you have to involve process, and then the process slows down. And I just don't think that's the place we want to go to. Doesn't sound like a fun way to go to grow the team that quickly. So hoping to slow that down and give myself some time to look at other stuff.
Well, I think that as you grow the team, I mean, people need to become comfortable, not just with each other, but like with the things that they're working on and how they work together. And if you grow too quickly, I saw this at Pedestal Software to some extent, because we grew from, I think I was the 4th engineer that was hired. And within, I don't know, it was probably a year, we were up to 10 or 15 or something like that. And when you have that many people added to a team that quickly, it's difficult to get on the same schedule is not quite the right way to phrase it, but like get in the same mental mode of working together, you know, get on the same page in terms of how you're doing stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. There's just an adjustment period when you're working with a new group of people on a new app.
Yeah, that's it. It's that adjustment period. It's hard to do that and scale it up very, very quickly without kind of having things go sideways very quickly as well.
Yeah. And so other, you know, kind of transitional stuff that's happened that's been really nice. I've been able to basically hand over support. Like LeadPages had, I don't even know, 20 people or something, 25 people on their support team, and we had 1. And so to have trials go up as high as they did, as quickly as they did, which is where the bulk of support's going to come, we just never would have been able to hire that quickly and certainly didn't have the budget to do it. So, you know, I've handed over the reins of that to their very capable team, HR, you know, obviously all HR stuff, right? There was no reason for me to be managing payroll and employee onboarding and insurance plans and just all that stuff. So that was good to hand over to them. Legal, affiliate management.
All the crappy parts of running a business.
Isn't it funny? Yeah. Everything I'm naming is like, you know, we are product people. Like, we want to build product. And there's all this other stuff that you have to do to have a company. And it's really nice when there's someone else there to do it. So my job has actually been filled with less, as Anders called it in his question. He kind of said the crap work. And for me, this is crap work for me personally, because of how I'm wired and because of my focus and what I'm good at. But it's actually someone else's sphere of genius. You know what I'm saying? It's the HR person. It's her sphere of genius. So she should be doing it. And, you know, the legal and the affiliate management, like, this is what they do full time. And so me having it as one of, you know, 50 things that I'm managing, it's just not going to be done anywhere near as well. And also, I mean, to be honest, like, I feel right now like we're getting to the point where we're starting to ship pretty quickly again. We scaled up. I mean, the first 30 to 60 days of after the acquisition was like, oh man, we need to add servers, we need to scale, like some things are starting to get slow. We had people come in trying to send spam. I mean, there's just all this stuff you're fighting. And then we got enough code written that we're out well ahead of that now. And that's given us a chance to really get back in and dig into features. And so we've shipped some pretty cool things in the past couple of weeks. And there's some fun changes I won't talk about yet, but that are going to be coming here in the next, you know, month or two.
Awesome. Well, I think we're kind of running out of time here, but I guess to kind of wrap things up a little bit. One of the things you'd asked me earlier was kind of how to make sure that things are moving forward in the way that they need to, and how I'm going to move the app ahead and put more people into it and actually scale up the customer side of things, as opposed to kind of digging in, as you said, and focusing too much on things that are not going to be as important or just simply aren't as important. And I think for that, for me, it's really a matter of putting together some goals. And I think that early on when I was first doing the customer development for it, I had some very concrete goals and I was highly focused on making sure that I was achieving like a certain number of calls per week and having conversations and converting people into the pre-orders. And I think I need to get back to that. I think I need to pick maybe one or two different KPIs that I'm going to go after and use those as benchmarks moving forward for at least the next month or two. I don't know off the top of my head what they are. I have some ideas, but I think I need to sit down and first thing is determine exactly what those are and then track those moving forward.
Yeah, totally. That sounds like a good thing. I feel like your number one focus right now, you know, should be getting more people on and getting them to pay you and figuring out if there are sticking points between them paying you, what those are, getting them hammered out, moving as quickly as possible. For me, to kind of wrap up, I mean, over the next few weeks, I'm going to be going to the Converted conference, which is the one Lead Pages puts on. And I think I'll have some stage time. I don't think I'm doing my own talk there, but talking about, you know, Drip and some other stuff. I've been spending a lot of time recruiting speakers for the two microconfs we're putting on in 6 months, which is, you know, a bit of an effort. And then on more of a personal note, it's a trip. I've been getting back more into investing. I'd kind of put that on the back burner a decade ago as I dove headlong into entrepreneurship, but it's always been an interest of mine since I was a kid. I think I bought my first share of stock when I was like 14 or 15. I had to do it through my dad's account, because obviously, you know, you have to be 18 or something to do it. Read a lot of books when I was younger, and I thought that was a way to make money. And as I learned, it's like investing is a way to grow money slowly and stay ahead of inflation. But almost no one gets rich, you know, or makes their millions purely from investing, starting with nothing. There's like two exceptions in the history of mankind or something. But now that, you know, I have a little bit of a nest egg from the Drip acquisition, it just makes a lot more sense to be more deliberate about it. Because with, you know, with a larger sum of money, it's like, just knowing more and doing 1 or 2% more per year, being a little more deliberate about it, it really is worth a substantial sum. And so that's actually been a lot of fun. Been listening to audiobooks. Actually, maybe at some point we could do a whole episode on it, because that's kind of what I'm doing with my spare time, is really thinking and looking about that and educating myself again and updating my skill set there. So I have a lot of thoughts on the topic. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.